Hello from the Talking Information Center, and welcome to The Poet's Voice, a program dedicated to the place of poetry in our lives and communities. Today, Gloria Monahan, poet, that's me, will interview poet John Holgersson. John lives in the southeastern Massachusetts, and our poems have appeared in numerous print and online journals. Between us, we've published 10 collections of poetry with more in progress. Today, I'll be talking with John about his insights and opinions concerning poetry, and we'll hear him read some of his poems. Hi, John.
Hi, Gloria. It's nice to be with you.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you're here. To get us started with some conversation and some poetry, John, can you please tell us about one of your favorite things to write about and read us one of your poems on that very topic?
One of the constant themes in my work deals with relationships, a person's relationships with those he or she loves, a person's relationship with the place he or she is at any given time, relationships with our society. Those are the themes pretty much that I favor. One poem that I will read to you, I wrote for my wife. We're 2 days away from Valentine's Day. So this is a poem I wrote in 2015. I was by myself on the Greek island of Hydra, which I hope we can talk about a little bit later when we get to other questions in the interview. I've been to the island before, and my wife has been there with me, but on this occasion she wasn't. And this is a poem I wrote for her at that time. It's called Ubiquity. I thought I could write just one damn poem without thinking of you. See one yellow flower along the uneven road's edge and not think of your hair. See one bluebird fluttering in the budding lemon trees and not think of your eyes. Late morning light melts the last stubborn shadows, warms the placid Aegean, and diminishes the stars. You are asleep beneath the same constant constellations, 5,000 miles from me. You are here.
Wow, that's really beautiful. I love that. John, when you're thinking about the power and place of poetry, how did it enter your life? Who introduced you to poetry? When did you start writing it?
I always was aware of poetry, but I didn't feel the power of it until I was 12. I was in the eighth grade. I went to a parochial school. I had a parochial high school, parochial elementary school, parochial college, parochial law school. And the nun was Sister Rosa Seal, and she had asked us to read the poem The Highwayman by Alfred Lord Noyes for homework. She didn't tell us the next day that she would be asking us to read it aloud in class. So I read it without reading it aloud, and I thought it was a great story. Then when we went to class the next day, she called on me to read the opening. And when I read the poem aloud, I was struck by the imagery in the poetry more than I had been the night before when I simply read it to myself. And I happened to have that first stanza that I read, and I use it as an example to show you exactly what I mean. The wind was a torrent of darkness among the gusty trees. The moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas. The road was a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor. And the highwayman came riding, 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 riding. The highwayman came riding up to the old inn door. The imagery in that stanza has definitely influenced my own writing, as well as the utilization of alliteration. It's just a beautiful, beautifully written stanza. It's an old poem. And it doesn't get talked about much except when you're in the eighth grade. But it's a great poem. And it definitely influenced me. And that was my first introduction to really wanting to write poetry.
Wow. Thank God for the nuns. That is so great. I wish I had a teacher like that. So, you know, you mentioned your education, and I'm wondering how your profession as a lawyer aligns with your work as a poet. Could you talk about that?
Well, when I was, after reading that poem, I didn't start writing poetry till I was 17, and I was a junior in high school. But when I was 18, I made the decision that I wanted to become an attorney. Now, I hadn't decided what kind of a lawyer. I just wanted to become a lawyer. And I applied to different universities that had six-year law programs. Usually you have to do 4 years undergraduate and 3 years in law school. So I wanted, because I wanted to be an attorney so quickly, I applied to just programs that had six-year law programs, 3 years undergrad, 3 years law school. And after I graduated from law school, I was still writing, but I was not writing as much as I could have been if I hadn't, if I were devoted to it. Because as soon as I got my license to practice, I became an attorney with the Massachusetts Defenders Committee, which is the, at the time was the name, this Commonwealth's name for the Public Defender's Office. And I was a trial and appellate attorney with that organization for a little more than 3 decades. And it's very important work representing the poor and representing those who couldn't afford their own lawyers for various reasons and who have a multitude of problems in their life. But I found the time not only to practice law and write poetry, but also found the time after I became a member of the bar to get married and have a family. And then it became a question of ordering of priorities as to devoting time, obviously, to my family and children first, and then to the law, and then to poetry. That was the usual order of priorities. But there were times when it was necessary for me to switch the priorities around and devote my time, most of it, to representing the people that needed to have me there most of the time. And so my family became a second priority, and poetry became a third. And then there was times when I took vacations by myself with my wife's blessing, and such as on the island of Idre that I'd mentioned earlier. And I made poetry my priority then, and my family was second, and then my work as an attorney. But I never tried to balance the three. I always put them in perspective as to which one was the most important on any given day. And that was where I had my focus on that given day. So it wasn't really a question of balancing. It was more or aligning. It was more a day-to-day looking at each of these three areas of my life and knowing which one required me to be in that moment at that time.
Wow, that's really, I think, helpful for our listeners to hear. You and I know that poems arrive from many different places, memory, image, phrase, etc. Would you please read us a poem of your own and tell us its origin story? You can either read the poem first or...
Well, I'll tell you the origin story first.
Yeah.
One day, this was probably back in 2014, 2013, somewhere along that line, I was at a bar in a Mexican restaurant with some friends. And we were celebrating a young lady's birthday. She was co-owner of a restaurant, but not that one. And she had just been given a gift certificate for a tattoo. And she had no tattoos. So I asked her, well, what exactly do you have in mind to get? I knew a little bit about her background, personal background. But she didn't give me a verbal answer. She went into her purse and took out a pen. And on a napkin, she started to draw a diagram of what she wanted for a tattoo. And as I looked at it, I knew there was a poem coming. I knew I was going to write a poem about what she was drawing. And I've been told that there have been many good ideas that have come about in the bars of Mexican restaurants. So I hope that this is one of them. It's the title poem for a chap, but my second book, which was a chapbook published by Finishing Line Press in 2016, called Unnecessary Tattoo and Other Stains on a Stainless Steel Heart. It's the book that the poem Ubiquity I read a moment ago, that's also in the same book. Unnecessary Tattoo. A bruised heart, cleaved in two, stitched down the middle. No mystery or enigma here, no obscure or secret riddle. It's there, behind your eyes. It's the catch in your voice at the mention of star-crossed lovers or the vagaries of choice. It can be seen in the ashes of the cigarettes you snuff out, the lingering sparks of memory in your holy grail of doubt. Don't tell me when it's done, the needle round and thin, the short, hot veneer of pain, the stain upon your skin. It's just another private part you'll likely hide from view, a duplicitous reminder, an unnecessary tattoo.
Wow, that was so filled with great images. I could almost felt like I was there with you.
You can thank the Highwaymen and Alfred Lloyd movies for my devotion to imagery.
John, the final question that I want to ask you, and I think this is so important for all poets and writers, is who was your poetry mentor and why?
Well, as I mentioned, I went to university that had a six-year law program. But as Robert Frost neatly points out in his poem about the road not taken, you do come upon a path that suddenly you say, wow, I didn't really know about this one. When I was a sophomore at the University of Notre Dame, which was the school that I went to for the six-year law program, I met a young professor who was just starting. His name was John Matthias. And Professor Matthias was teaching a course in British poets. So part of his teaching style was on Friday nights to invite members of his class that he was teaching that semester to his home to read, if they were writing their own poetry, to read their poetry. He would read his, we would read ours. We talk about the poems. We read other people's poems. His wife would serve us milk and cookies, literally, because none of us were over the age of 21, so therefore we couldn't drink anything, obviously. Her name was Diana. And Professor Matthias was only 6 years older than we were, so he was very close in age to us. And he would tell each of us after we read our poetry, he would tell us what he thought of it, and he would encourage us. And he encouraged me to write my poetry more seriously. He told me that what I had was okay, but he felt that I could write much better and if I took it more seriously. And so I took his words to heart, and I tried very hard. In fact, I am probably the only third-year law student in any law school in the country who has an elective called Modern Poetry, which I took as a graduate course with Professor Matthias my last year of law school. And that is on my transcript. I'm really kind of proud of that. So Professor Matthias has written 18 collections of poetry, 6 plays, 3 memoirs, 2 collections of short stories, and has been a really influential person in my life. When I go back to school to visit the campus, I make arrangements, or in the past, I always made arrangements to meet with him. We met at a Greek restaurant. We would, over stuffed grape leaves and red wine, we would talk about the state of poetry at that time and what was going on in each of our lives. And those meetings meant a lot to me. Then during the pandemic years, 2020 and 2021, he lost his wife, Diana, from complications of COVID, long COVID. And I kind of lost track with him over those years. But I will read you one of his poems that impressed me. and then I will read you a poem I wrote for him. This is called My Youngest Daughter, Running Toward an English Village Church. Sunday then, in Trumpington, and nearby Bells, my daughter runs among the village graves this foggy January morning of her early youth as I lie late in bed and watch her from my window. I know she holds her breath. Superstitious, she'll hold it till she passes by the final marker near the door and disappears inside. If you breathe in cemeteries, you inhale evil spirits. What do you inhale when you breathe in stony churches or in bedrooms where you wake alone and realize you cannot tell your child's superstition from her faith? Beyond the church, a village green, a meadow, the pleasures and the picnics of next spring, I tell her not to hold her breath in graveyards, watching her red coat become a gaudy blur against the brilliant hoarfrost. I realize I'm holding mine.
That's just gorgeous. What a beautiful, beautiful image. What beautiful poetry. John, at this point,
I have the one poem I'd like to read that I wrote for Professor Mathias.
Oh, great.
It's called, it's in my first book of poetry called Broken Borders. It was published by Wasteland Press in 2012. It's called So We Are All Sitting for John Mathias. So we're all sitting in this classroom. It was the Rolling Stones' painted black 60s, bell-bottom jeans or corduroys, beads and long hair, but not down the back. It was Notre Dame, 4 years of male bonding with only St. Mary's women on campus. Rally, sons of Notre Dame, what though the odds be great or small. We were there, strangers, year two, semester two, day one. The professor walks in, bell-bottom corduroys, beard, and long hair, but not down the back. He looks around, some sort of semi-smile on his face. He knows we know it is his first or second class, but it will not be a second-class class. He focuses on no one, on everyone. He sits on the corner of his desk, corduroy bell-bottoms, exposing boots with made-for-walking heels, and he opens this book, Babette Deutsch, on poetry. Turns it face down on his desk like he knows some secret we don't, which he does, but we don't know that then, not till many lines later, when it dawns on me, in the midst of feeding my head, writing some stanza in a courtroom with a client waiting for the jury's verdict.
Fantastic. You know, your poems are so visual, John. I'm hoping that we can take this moment to now turn to you for some more poetry. Can you read some more poems for us?
Certainly.
Thank you.
I'm going to read a poem, again, from Broken Borders, that I wrote for my daughter after she had been accepted to college, and she wasn't going that far away from home, but she was living on campus. It's called In the Hallway. And I think this is an experience that many parents who have their children go away to college experience or have. In the hallway, for Alyssa, invoked apparitions of your childhood parade toward me in the hallway, a smiling toddler with braided hair next to a deeply tanned ponytailed teenager, the face of innocence never disappointed, asleep on a blue pillow, melds into resignation distilled from the never-timely deaths of Santa Claus and Sandy the Candy Elf. Skinny legs in cut-off jeans assume length and shape in dungaree skirts, morphing to false modesty in pants belonging to unloved, rarely worn, gray-striped business suits. These phantoms appear in a mob of memories as I stand staring, eyes wide shut, in the doorway of your old room, in a house grown silent of children's laughter. The last poem, I had some fun with this next poem. It's not quite the last poem in the book of Broken Borders, but we all know the story of Don Quixote, the guy who thought he was a knight-errant, old man who thought he was a knight-errant, thought windmills were giants, thought that his worker helper, Sancho Panza, was his squire. And Sancho Panza was always trying to tell Don Quixote, hey, those are not giants, those are windmills. And he was always trying to convince Don Quixote that he was not living in the real world. But Don Quixote never listened to Sancho Panza until the very end. And then it was too late. Spoiler alert, if you haven't read the book. On his deathbed, Don Quixote sits up and realizes that what he thought was the reality wasn't. And he passes away, having come to that sudden realization. So I thought, what if Sancho Panza actually got to Don Quixote, actually convinced him before all that, that this wasn't the real reality? What would Don Quixote's reaction be? So this is called Don Quixote After Therapy. I'm broken and I'm bitter by the heart's forced retreat, the fundamental loss incurred with age, love's defeat. I knelt whenever beauty passed, laid down my heavy lance, arose a better man each time, encouraged by her glance. I fought and died for beauty, not knowing I was unarmed. She never promised anything, never said I'd go unharmed. I'm bitter and I'm broken by age, love's defeat, the fundamental loss incurred with the heart's forced retreat. I don't recognize that image in the hallway mirror, the gray and wrinkled flesh inside this phony armor. The glacial cold of loneliness freezes me on crowded streets where deformed and crippled hearts still pause, yet never care to meet. They've taken down the road signs that mark the narrow ways I wandered for a lifetime within this twisted maze. I'm broken and I'm bitter by the heart's forced retreat, the fundamental loss incurred with aged love's defeat. The next poem I want to read, a couple of poems that I wrote while I was on the Greek island of Hydra. I first went to the Greek island of Hydra in 1970, and I was there looking for the Canadian poet, singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen, but he had left the island 3 years before. Without the internet, you never know those things. Back in 1970, there weren't even cell phones, never mind internet. So, oh, by the way, I would eventually meet Leonard twice, once in 1975 and again in 2012. And I'm going to start by reading a poem that I dedicated to him after he had passed away in 2016, because I would always go by his house when I was on the island where he lived. It was one of those things like, I hate to call it a shrine, that's going a little far, but I'd walk past it and sort of glide my fingertips along it, just looking for inspiration. This is called Hydra, April 2019, for Leonard Cohen, 1934 to 2016. I stood outside your old home today, as I've done in years past. Tangled ivy vines from the roof terrace stretched down the wall toward me, a thin, green, leafy rope, inviting me to grab its strands with both hands and pull myself up. If I was a younger man, perhaps, but my wall-scaling days ceased long ago. Instead, I looked for the wire and the bird. I saw the former, a tightrope taut and thin, pole tied between red-roofed white houses. There was no sparrow, but I'm still here, listening for what cannot be heard. I put my hand on the wall of your house, hoping the lingering remnant of a once-strummed guitar riff or the clickety-clack of your old olive-green Olivetti would course through my fingertips, run the maze of jagged lines on my smooth palm, up my willing arm to the area of the brain, or whatever part of the soul sends messages to the muse assigned to a scribbler of verse. But it doesn't work that way, does it, Leonard? That singular muse here for you then isn't mine, although I'd like to think they may be sisters, or more likely cousins, once or twice removed. At Duco's Taverna, I dined on fresh Ziphius under the huge old pine tree, where once upon a time, before fame and fortune fell upon you, you sat, sang, played guitar for Mariana, and all your idiot friends. I'll come by tomorrow. You never know. Someone or something may be at home. That poem comes from my most recent collection of poetry called Convictions of the Heart, which was published in 2021. So I'll read one other poem about the island of Idra itself to give you an idea, a little bit of what it's like. There are no cars on the island. It has two ambulances. That's all. I take that back. It has a big red Toyota pickup truck. That is its fire truck. So besides the two ambulances and the fire truck, there are no other motorized vehicles on the island. You can ride a bike around the island, but you can't ride it within the municipalities. And there's Idra Town, which is the port, the biggest municipality on the island, and there are five other small villages scattered around the perimeter of the island. I wrote this when I was there in 2010. Idra, October 2010. The fishing boats scuttle daily in and out of the Horseshoe Harbor, wooden and fiberglass crabs seeking a shoal of squid or sponge. Tourist shops are bringing in their postcard sentry stanchions and wobbly wood tables with multicolored T-shirts bearing the island's name. Old-timers stroke sweat from bearded chins as they play pinochle and backgammon for beer and sausages in the old bars behind the yacht-lined harborfront. The air has become burdened by the thick weight of an alien humidity. It clings to the linings of the lungs like the pseudosode clothes on our bodies. And like the ancient rapacious pirates buried unceremoniously in unmarked graves, this bullying son of global burning has stormed the island's pine forests and seaboard, drying the groves to tinder while pushing up the beach's sandy skirts so the Aegean can take by force areas beyond, once beyond, its greedy tidal grasp. Some stores along the harborfront will soon shut their double doors until April, when the poppies and tourists will both bloom again, and the winter winds from Egypt and Israel will have blown this bastard mugginess westward, along with some sudden, yet expected, Sahara sand.
Wow, John, that was really great, and it makes me really want to go to that island. So I'm going to put that on my bucket list. John, thank you so much for sharing your work and your take on the poet's voice. And thanks to our audience for joining us. Listeners, if you'd like to follow our program, remember to check your TIC listings for future broadcasts of The Poet's Voice.